The Gemara in Yevamah says, Amar Reb Yitzchak, Mahayu Avosenu Akurim. Why is it that the Avos were all barren? And the Gemara explains to us, it doesn't mean that the Avos and the Imos had trouble conceiving. It means they physically could not have children. They didn't have the organs necessary. They were incapable of having children. And why is it that they were Akurim? Why is it that they were barren? Mimnei Shekadosh Baruch Hu Misav L'Tfilosam Shel Tzadikim. Because Hashem desires the tefillahs of tzaddikim. Because Hashem wanted them to daven, Hashem wanted them to reach out, therefore Hashem made them barren so that they'll have a reason to cry out, they'll have a reason to daven, therefore they were born in this way. The Medrash Tanchuma expands on this a little bit, Amar Reb Levi, again the same expression, why is it that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created them this way? HaKadosh Baruch Hu Misavel Tfilosam. Hashem desires his tefillahs. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem said, Ashirusen, the imos are very wealthy. Noosin, they're beautiful. Imani nosin lembonim, if I give them children, Einam mispalos sulfani, they're not going to daven in front of me. They're rich, they're attractive, they have all their needs met. If I give them children, they're not going to daven. Therefore, because Hashem desires the tefillahs of the tzaddikim, therefore Hashem made them barren. And I'd like to ask two very basic questions on this, on the Gemara and on the Medrash. The first question is that it just doesn't seem nice. Okay, let's grant the fact that Hashem desires the tefillah of tzaddikim. Hashem wants that. But it doesn't seem very nice to torture these fine women. Sarah Imenu spent 75 years without a child. Rivka spent 20 years. They went through a tremendously painful, traumatic experience year after year, decade after decade, davening, Hashem, please, please, please. It sounds torturous. If Hashem desires the tefillahs of tzaddikim, don't take it out on the tzaddikim. That's question one. But question number two, I think, is even more basic. And that is that the Avos davened. How do we know that? Because Avram established Shachris. Mincha was established by Yitzchak, and Yaakov established Maariv. In fact, the Achronim tell us that all the Avos and Imos all daven three times a day. It just happens to be that Avram was the one who firmly established Shachris, Yitzchak Mincha, Yaakov Maariv, but the point being they davened. So what is the Gemara saying? That Hashem desires the tefillahs, therefore made them barren so that they'll daven. They davened anyway. They established these things, and it's clear that we didn't need this, they would have been mispalel anyway. So the question is, what's pshat in this Gemara, what's pshat in the Medrash? And to shed some light on this question, I'd like to share with you something that's a bit interesting. The next time you crack open an egg, and most likely it'll be your child who'll ask you, but what's that little white spot? And you'll see every egg, every single chicken egg that you crack has a little white spot in it, about 2 to 3 centimeters in size, millimeters in size, very small little spot over there. That little spot is called the germ cell. That is the part of the chicken that will actually grow into the embryo. If it's impregnated, it will actually become the part of the embryo that will actually be the chicken. The way the egg is formed in the hen is the yolk itself is created somewhere in the oviduct before the, there's a long oviduct in the hen. The yolk is created with that little germ cell. As it begins passing through the oviduct, the body of the hen secretes this white, the albumin, the white part of the egg to surround it. The various membranes are placed around it. As it goes further down towards the end of the oviduct, the hen secretes that part that becomes a shell, and then that egg exits the hen. It takes about 24 hours. But here's the interesting part about the whole reproductive cycle. The rooster will lay some semen inside the body of the rooster, of the hen. That sperm will remain in there for up to 10 days. What happens is, as the yolk is traveling down, if the sperm swims up and meets that yolk, it'll attach itself to the germ disk. It's chemically attracted, almost like a torpedo that's chemically attracted specifically for that germ disk. It will then impregnate that germ disk, and the sperm will now become the growing part of the embryo. The albumin is then surrounds it. Various parts firmly attach the yolk to the white of the egg. As it travels down, more membranes are placed around it. Finally, the eggshell is formed around it. And now you have a fertilized egg that actually exits the chicken. But here's the point. The egg is completely contained. Nothing enters it. Nothing exits. It's semi-permeable, some gases transfer, but everything that's in the egg is in the egg. That embryo will begin forming, and it'll begin dividing, the cells will begin dividing, divide, until after 21 days you have a fully formed chicken. Now, if you'd like to study the Nephloa Sabori, we mentioned this once in a previous shmooze, the chicken has a very real challenge in front of it. It is a little chickling, it is rather small, but it fills up the entire contents of the egg. In fact, it's really compressed out against the eggshell. Because as it grows, it grows, it grows, it eats up the yolk, which is its perfect nourishment. It begins forming the wings, the legs, the entire body of a small, teeny, teeny chicken. But it fills up the entire eggshell and it cannot escape. The eggshell is geometrically perfect to contain both that keep the chicken inside, as well as allow the mother to sit on it. It's exactly the shape that it disperses the weight so that the mother hen can sit on it, keep it warm without crushing it. But because it's so strong for its size, the little chicken is inside and cannot get out. It's contained within the walls of the eggshell and really has no room to stretch, and it is should die. However, Hashem in His wisdom created something called the egg tooth. The egg tooth is a temporary appendage that surfaces in the chicken for a very short time, and shortly after its birth it leaves. And this egg tooth is formed somewhere in the mouth. What the chicken does inside the egg is it begins pecking. When it's fully formed and it's ready to exit, it has this instinct to begin pecking. And the slight pecking eventually creates a crack. Once there's a crack, the pressure from its wings allows the crack to form. Crack, out comes the chicken, happily living, following its mother. But here's the most astounding part. Everything that happens in the egg happens there with all the nutrients, all the nourishment contained within the eggshell. There's nothing added. All of the nourishment that the tiny germ cell, which is now impregnated, needs for its further development and growth is there. And that, says the Chovos Levavos, is actually a very important point for us to think about. And that is that Hashem provides the needs of everything. All of the animals of the wild, even the chick inside the shell, are provided for it right there. One more observation. There are now nuclear submarines that can remain at sea 60 days at a time, 80 days at a time. The Russians now have a category, a class of submarines that can remain submerged for 6 months at a time. Because they're nuclear powered, nuclear reactors are constantly giving off the energy that it needs. It is self-sufficient for 6 months at a time. Really, it could last longer. The nuclear reactor could really keep it going almost ad infinitum, but they run out of stores, supplies, etc. So it'll have to surface, but for 6 months at a time, they can remain there. Now, Columbus discovered America. He did not invent it. Columbus sailed in that ship searching for India. He found this landmass that no one knew about, and he discovered America. But no one would ever accuse Columbus of inventing America. And what I mean by that is a very simple point. When scientists discover a new phenomena, a new technology, they believe that they have invented it. The reality is that no scientist ever invented anything. He uncovered that which was contained within nature. When scientists learned to harness the energy contained within an atom, they didn't invent the atom, nor the bonds that attach one atom to the other. They discovered how to release those energy bonds. They invented nothing. They discovered that which Hashem created before Maisa Bereishis. And the Chovos Levavos makes a very important point, and that is that any time scientists uncover something, that's something that Hashem wanted them to know at that time, in that generation. They've invented nothing, but they've uncovered that which Hashem wants them to uncover at that particular time. With those two points being said, here's the following question. It is clear that Hashem is quite capable of supporting the embryo as it grows in the eggshell fully well. Hashem can invent an atomic force that can keep a submarine going for 6 months, 6 years, 60 years at a time. Why then is it that Hashem made man, as Hashem made us, with so many various needs? We constantly need food, air, water. We're very, very needy. If Hashem is clearly quite capable of creating anything that Hashem wants, why didn't Hashem make the human, much like the ever-ready bunny? You turn him on in the morning and he goes 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 and he never tires. Doesn't need sleep, doesn't need food, doesn't need drink. You turn him on when he's born, he goes throughout his life, day after day, week after week. Says the Chafetz Chaim, there's a bracha that we say specifically that refers to this. And that bracha is Borei Nefashos Rabos VeChesronon. Hashem, you created many, many creations. There are 1.5 million species of living creatures on this planet. Amongst all of those that you created, there's tremendous wisdom. Each of them that you created also have their needs. Rabos, many, VeChesronon, and their needs were also created. Every single animal in the animal kingdom has various needs. Man as well has many, many needs. And the question that a thinking person should ask himself is, gee, golly, why? Why make man with all of these needs, food, water, etc., etc., make man just go, start the day, finish going, and he never gets hungry, tired, never needs to sleep? And I believe that this question really is quite fundamental and quite critical in understanding what the human is about. And to focus on this, let me mention something briefly that we've discussed quite a number of times in the Shmooze, and that is that the human personality is comprised of two very distinct parts. There's a part of me that's pure seichel, pure intellect, that only wants to do that which is right, proper, and good. And there's a nefesh abahami, there's a physical entity within me, the physical drives, the passions, the appetites, the hungers. Each one of these parts are vying for primacy, they're fighting, they're competing for the totality of I, for rulership, dominion over me. I am comprised of both, and I am a conglomerate of these two parts. Now, with that being said, here's the following observation. If man were asked to have total bitachon b'Hashem, totally rely on Hashem and Hashem only, and not work a day in his life, it would be pretty simple. Why? Because there's a full half of my personality that understands intuitively and instinctively that Hashem is present everywhere. And therefore, for me to sit in the Beis Medrash and contemplate Hashem's presence, learn to rely on Hashem and trust in Hashem, would be rather simple. So too, if I were asked to do the opposite. Imagine that I were asked to understand that Hashem is not involved at all in the runnings of the world. Imagine that my job was to totally take care of my needs, imagining, much like secular people do think, that God is not involved in the running of the world, but it's my job to take care of my needs, my health, my well-being are totally within my hands. I claim that too would be rather simple, because there's a full half of my personality that demands that that's true. And there's a full half of me says, there is no creator, there's no one involved other than me. If I don't earn my living, I'm going to starve to death. So that position also would be rather simple. But man was not asked to do either extreme. Man was asked to take this most difficult walk down a very, very thin path. That thin path is to be very diligent in my hishtadlus and to use my best effort to go out there to earn a living, knowing full well that it doesn't really matter. It's totally biyad Hashem. The essence of bitachon, says the Chovos Levavos, is to embrace the decree. To know that Hashem decrees on Rosh Hashanah how much money I will make, whether I'll have a year of success or failure, and whether I'll have a year of health or the opposite. And while knowing that fact with absolute clarity, my job is to go out there and work, my job is to go out there and take care of my health, my job is to go out there and act b'derech hateva in the way of nature. And this duality, knowing that it's completely beyond Hashem and the demand that I be totally involved, is a very, very difficult, thin line to walk, and that is what is demanded of the human. And the reason why Hashem demands that from us because that is the way the human perfects himself. That is the way the human grows. That is the way the person reaches great heights. And that is the way the person reaches the ability to have his nefesh, asikli, his seichel, win out over his body by being active in this world, using this world, understanding that it's a bit false and a mirage. And if you'd like to understand this difficult dilemma, I have a very simple mashal that I think well sums it up. A number of years back, my kids convinced me to go into one of these virtual roller coasters. Now, if you've ever been in them, they're rather interesting. It's basically kind of a box with two seats. You sit in one seat, your kid or someone else sits in the next seat, and they close the hatch. And they do everything in their power to make it real. Even the wind blowing, the fans blowing, and this arm sort of lifts the whole cab up. And then on the screen in front of you, they're showing the scene as if you were in a roller coaster. You'll see the track, you'll see the mountains, you'll see whatever the scenes are, and then it starts. The roller coaster starts, and as you're climbing up, the cab itself starts shaking because it's simulating the actual movement. And as you get higher and higher, it's shaking a little bit more, and as the roller coaster scene in front of you sort of dips down, the cab itself dips up, and you fall the free fall, and it begins moving out and just shaking and you're moving, and the scene is coming at you and the wind goes faster, and it goes through the whole scene as the roller coaster track sort of turns, the cap turns this way, then it turns over completely, you flip over, then you flip over this way, back, forward, back, forward, 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 back. About 2 minutes later, the ride is over, and you land, they open the cab. Now, I will admit to you that when I got out, I was nauseous. And the reason I was nauseous is because when you go around, 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 this way, that way, that way, eventually you get nauseous. But not for a moment, not for a moment was I scared. And I'd like to share with you why. You see, if it ever looked too real, if it ever looked like it was really, really a dangerous situation, like we were going to crash into something, all I had to do was look at the floor and say, ha, it's a bluff, it's a fake, it's not real, it's a video. So I wasn't scared the entire time I was in there. And that, my friends, I believe is a very apt mashal for life. Throughout life, you're going to be thrown many scary situations, whether it's earning a living, whether it's health, whether it's finding your basharet, all the various situations of life, you're going to face many scary, scary situations. If you'd like to know the proper attitude that a Jew should have, you have to go out there and act as if it's real, knowing that it's a mirage. It's a fake, it's a bluff. Hashem has decreed exactly who I am to marry, exactly when. Hashem has decreed how much money I am to make, exactly what time. Which house, which business, etc. My job is to go out there and do my ishtadlis. If I don't do my best effort, then in fact I may not earn that which I'm supposed to earn. But provided that I've done my appropriate ishtadlis, provided that I'm out there doing what I should be doing, everything is totally with the decree. And my job is to embrace the decree, to accept it, to accept exactly what Hashem was gozer upon me. To understand that there's an illusion called reality. And all those scary things like bankruptcy, like markets crashing, like doctors telling you I have some bad news, they're mirages, they're illusions, they're not real. That which we call reality isn't. And that is a very, very difficult challenge for the human to go out there and be active, be busy, work for a living, and all the while you're working for a living, to see it as a mirage. See, again, if I were asked to sit in the Beis Medrash and only learn and not take care of my needs, it'd be simple enough. Or the opposite. If I were asked to go out there and work and take care of my needs, it would be also simple. But I'm asked to do this almost impossible duality and be out there working aggressively, working very diligently, and know that it's a mirage and a fake. And that is a very difficult kav, a very difficult line to fully get. Hashem gave us one tool to fully grasp this concept and one mechanism that helps us dramatically. And that mechanism is something called tefillah. And I'll explain to you what I mean. There's a certain point when a human being gets it, when he recognizes the fact that I do not have the capacity. Maybe it's when you lose your job. Maybe it's when the Dow Jones drops 1,000 points in one day. But at some point, the human gets it, I can't do it. And if at that moment they stand in front of their Creator and they say the words, Hashem, it is not in my capacity. I've searched for my Basharit for years now and I can't find her. I can't do it, Hashem, I rely on you. That is a life-changing experience. Because what the person understands at that moment is, it's not in my capacity, it's up to Hashem. And then, if Hashem grants that which I've requested, if Hashem grants that which I've been searching for, and I get whether it's the job, the parnasa, the wife, or whatever it may be, the human being has a vastly different version of life. You see, at that point, I cut through the mirage. I've got the fact that it's beyond Hashem, Hashem then granted it to me, and then my entire life is viewed with different eyes. I then understand very clearly that this is a mirage, that which is called reality isn't, and I reach a different vista. And I believe that that's exactly why HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Mis'avel Tfilosim Shel Tzadikim. Rachel Imenu was a tremendous person, but she needed tefillah. But not tefillah as in Shachris, Mincha, or Mariv. She needed a need. When she didn't have something, she needed to reach out to Hashem and say, Hashem, I can't do it. I rely on you, I trust in you. And then when Hashem granted it, she reached a vastly different level. As great as the most were, as great as the others were, they needed needs, they needed to reach out, to be without, to say, Hashem, it's beyondcha only. And then when Hashem granted that request, they reached a totally different point. They became the people they were because of these needs. And what Chazal are telling us is that it doesn't matter who you are. You could be as great as Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. If you have everything and you don't need Hashem, it's very difficult to reach that madriga. The reason Hashem made them barren was because they needed that need so that they could catapult themselves to new heights, and they could reach a different vista, they could reach the level of literally seeing Hashem in their life, and the nisyonos of life make the person. And this concept that nisyonos make the person is a very fundamental one to understanding life. And the reason why I chose to speak about this particular concept right now is because, again, as I mentioned to you, I was recently at the Aguda Convention. And the Aguda Convention focused on one particular issue. And that issue is Emuna in turbulent times. That was the theme. Many of the speakers, many of the workshops discussed that particular issue. And I'd like to share with you a perspective. But before I share with you a perspective, I want to share with you a perspective on nisyonos in general. And that is as follows. Eli Wiesel, when he first began speaking in America, tried to let the American public know what had gone on in the Nazi concentration camps. Keep in mind the fact that there was no Holocaust literature. This was 1945, right after the war. No one had written about it. No one really understood. So he set his task to write, to lecture, to tell the world what had gone on in the Nazi concentration camps. And he describes it in one of his early lectures. He tells over what it was like. How they were treated like worms, how they were fed literally one slice of bread and some watery soup for an entire day's rations. Their life was worth less than a dime. He described exactly what it was like for an entire lecture and what it was like living in Auschwitz. When he was done, he opened the floor to questions. One woman raised her hand and asked as follows, Mr. Wiesel, may I ask the following? Tell me, how often did the Nazi guards change your linens? He said, he couldn't respond. There clearly was a division between his reality and the way she perceived it. How often did they change the linens? Ma'am, I don't know if you understood. We wore tatters, slept on bare wood, stuffed like sardines with bed bugs and lice. We were lucky if we could use the latrine. How often they changed the sheets? What sheets? But he recognized at that point was that there was a great divide between the reality and the American public's understanding of that reality. But my friends, those were nishonos, once upon a time, that Jews lived through. I just recently had an opportunity to sit with Rabbi Schoenfeld, and he told me about the Hustaner Rebbe. Rabbi Schoenfeld was in Vienna when the Nazis marched in. And the first thing the Nazis did was march out the 8 or 9 Hasidic Rebbes who lived in that area and made them scrub the streets. there was all kinds of graffiti, anti-Nazi graffiti in the streets, so they gave them scrub brushes and made them at gunpoint get on their knees and scrub off the graffiti. One Rebbe, the Hushtener Rebbe, was brought to a different level of Nisayan. The Nazis brought a scissor out and said to him, "Cut your beard." And you have to understand, the Nazis would have killed a Jew like that. The Hushtener Rebbe said, "I will not cut my beard. You could take these scissors and you could stab me with them, but I will not cut my beard." At which point, Rabbi Schoenfeld said, and he was an eyewitness to the event, they kicked him around a bit and they left him. But you see, these were nishonos that once upon a time Jews had to suffer through. Chasdei Hashem, we live in vastly different times. We live in very different circumstances, and those are not our nishonos. And I don't mean to make light of the current financial meltdown. However, putting it into perspective, it is a vastly different situation that we are living through than historically we have in the past. However, we do have to deal with it. We do have to deal with it. And the question is, what is the right attitude of a Ben Torah? And what is the Torah's approach when the entire financial marketplace seems to be cascading downward? How do we approach this? How do we deal with it? How do we have bitachon in turbulent times? So I'd like to share with you a bit of a perspective on this. A woman approached me with the following dilemma. She said, "Rabbi, how do I do tshuva?" I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "I lost my emunah." What happened? Well, I sold my house, and then I went to buy another house, and in the contract, detail after detail, bottom line is she lost a substantial sum of money, and she said, "I lost my emunah for 3 days, and I had no emunah. Baruch Hashem, I got it back, but how do I do tshuva? Emunah is everything. How do I do tshuva for my lack of emunah?" Now, I'd like to share with you the perspective that I believe this woman didn't quite have. And to understand this perspective, let's focus on one point. If you've ever looked at the distance of a marathon race is 26.2 miles. 26 miles and 385 yards to be exact. The average runner will run that in some 4.5 hours. If you'd like an eye glimpse in terms of what that is, just understand the next time you get on the treadmill and you last for about 20 minutes. Imagine that you're going to sit on that treadmill, not for 20 minutes, not for an hour, but for 4.5 hours running, 26.2 miles. And if you think about it, it's mind-boggling that the human body can endure that length, that distance, that challenge. With that being said, I'd like to share with you an interesting observation. If you are 40 years of age or younger, in reasonably good health, you can run a marathon. Now, don't make a mistake. Don't go out tonight and go try to run 26.2 miles because Hatzalah will pick you up somewhere shy of the 26.2 miles. However, if you train for a year or 2 years, you can run a marathon. How do I know this? Look at the entrance into the average marathon. The New York City Marathon has over 30,000 people in it. There are a few select elite athletes in the very front. Those are the guys who run in 2 hours and 10 minutes. But the vast, vast majority are regular people. People in their 30s, in their 40s, many in their 50s, who are just regular sorts of people. Lawyers, doctors, Indian chiefs. And if you ask them what happened, well, we just made up our minds and we decided to train for it. And it's a rather strange thing. Many of them never ran before they took on the challenge of the marathon. And there are all kinds of programs and all kinds of books written as to how to do it. The first time you go out there, you put on your running shoes and you try to run for 15 minutes. You can't run a full 15 minutes, run a little bit. When you get tired, walk. Run, walk, run, walk. After a week or so, you'll be able to run 15 minutes. Then you work on running for 20 minutes, then a half hour, then an hour. And if you continue this regimen, you begin building up miles, and you begin training 4 times a week. And after about a year, a strange thing happens. You put on your running shoes and you find yourself 8, 10 miles later feeling great. And you're running and your body's just on automatic pilot and you've just run 10 miles and you still have plenty of gas in the tank. After another year of this, you put on your running shoes, you enter marathon, and bingo, you run 26.2 miles, average regular people. Now, It's not about the marathon, because most people do not plan on winning it. It's about the training and the change in physicality that occurs to the human during it. You lose a tremendous amount of body fat. Your entire cardiovascular system improves. The average person doing this will extend his lifespan by 6 to 9 years. But here's the point. You don't run the marathon, you train for it. So too, no one has bitachon. There is not a human being born who has bitachon. You train in bitachon. What that means is you go through various life tests and you win. You put your mind on, you think about things, you grow step after step, level after level. You train in bitachon, and if you train long enough and hard enough, you become a vastly different person. When that woman said to me, I failed the test, she didn't fail the test because she didn't begin training. She didn't begin working on the test. When was the last time that she picked up a Musar Sefer? When was the last time she listened to a Musar Shmuz about Emunah, about Bitachon, worked on it, thought about it, and now after 2 years of really working on it, now she was given the test and she failed. The reality is that most people don't work on Bitachon, so there's no test to Bitachon, they're not working on it. It's not about running the marathon, it's about training for it. So too, when it comes to this area called Bitachon, it's not about passing the test. It's about training, it's about living through life with a different understanding so that you become a vastly different person. And to help us focus on this concept of Bitachon, I'd like to share with you first a thought and then two, maybe three Musar exercises. The thought is something that the Chovos of Avos explains to us. He says, if you'd like to understand Hashem's relationship to this world, he says, imagine that you have a person who opened a great hotel. He invites his friends and neighbors to this hotel. Now, because he's invited them to his palace, it's his obligation to take care of his guests. And says the Chovos of Avos, Hashem feels a tremendous obligation, kaviyachol, if it could be, to take care of all of his creations. As if to say, I created you, now it's my job to take care of you. And my friends, it's not just man. It's the 1.5 million living species, the 10 million species of life that exists on the planet in all forms. Hashem created them, Hashem made them with many needs, and Hashem provides for all of their needs. The entire ecosystems, all of them, integrated, harmoniously functioning, Hashem takes care of all of them, man included. Hashem created us, and kaviyachol Hashem feels an obligation to take care of us. However, that requires an awful lot of work on our part to understand it. And I'd like to share with you a few Musar exercises, how I can get that very big concept clearly in front of my mind. Here's the concept. The next time you sit down and wash, and you make the following bracha, I want you to think about these words. Baruch Ata Hashem, blessed be you God, Elokeinu, our God, Melech HaOlam, King of the Universe, HaMotzi Lechem Min HaOretz, you bring forth bread from the ground. And as you're saying those words, I want you to say to yourself, I just lied. Because God did not bring forth this bread from the ground. I bought it in the bakery. I went to Zisha's or Thomas's muffins or whoever baked it. Those were the people who brought forth. Maybe the farmer in Minnesota who planted the wheat, harvested it, and brought it to market, but surely not HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But would you like to know what you're saying when you say those words? What you're acknowledging is one fundamental concept, and that is that Hashem created this world, maintains it, and orchestrates it. And the reason why there are market economies that exist and flourish are not by accident, and not because of the beauty of capitalism, and not because of free market. The reason they exist and they run is because Hashem says there should be free markets so that human beings should have what to eat. In fact, the Chovos of Avos shares the fundamental yesod with us. He says, really, there should be no economy. There should be no currency. All of exchange should be barter. But that's rather inconvenient. It's rather cumbersome for me to trade my ox for your pieces of wood. Hashem wanted there to be an economy, therefore Hashem wanted there to be currency, and the way Hashem did that was by putting a mishigas, by putting an insanity into the heart of man. Gold is soft yellow metal. Man hungers for gold. Man lusts for gold that is irrational. And the reason why man has such a craving for gold is because Hashem put a foolish concept in man's mind to desire it and to want it. Why? Because once there's something that's so precious, you now have a system of currency. You now can measure one ox is equal to so many ounces of gold, which is the equivalent in wood or in furniture. You now can have an economy because you now have currency. The reason why Hashem put this insane drive, lust for gold, is because Hashem wants it to be an economy, wants it to be currency, and when you study the world, what you're looking at is Hashem's running of the world. If you'd like to know what pshat is when we make that bracha, it's really quite simple. I acknowledge the fact that Hashem runs this entire world, the entire market, and everything that goes into it. From John Deere, who manufactures the plows, to the petrol dealers who sell the petroleum, to the farmer in Minnesota who plants the seeds, the entire process guided, directed by Hashem so that we should have food on our table. And when you say that bracha, you're acknowledging a tremendous manifestation of Hashem's orchestrating this world. Hamotzi lechem and aretz Hashem, you created this world, maintain it, and you orchestrate everything that happens. And that bracha is a huge quantum leap forward in understanding. However, it is very difficult to always keep that in front of my mind's eye, especially as the Dow Jones begins to sink, especially when I can't open the papers without hearing more bad news, and more bad news. And at a certain point, a person says, oh my goodness, I'm not going to be able to feed my children. I'm not going to be able to pay my mortgage. I am in deep, dire trouble. And so at that point, I'd like to share with you what a Jew can do about that. You see, once upon a time, people used to work for their daily bread. Once upon a time, we used to have to earn the food we ate. We no longer do that. We now work for many other things, but food is very easily accessible. But the basic concept of parnasa has to do with food. And if you do this following exercise, I almost guarantee it will change your perspective on bitachon. It may sound a bit radical, and it may sound a bit novel, but try me on this fantastic musar exercise. It's called, read the words of benching and pay attention to them. And if you actually pay attention to those words, you'll find novel concepts, novel things that you may never have thought about before. And listen to these words, Baruch At Hashem, blessed be you God, right here, present, right here. Elokeinu, our God, Melech Olam, King of the world. Hazan Esa Olam Kulo, you feed the entire world. Kulo, in totality, from the giraffe to the orangutan to the baboons, all of their needs are met. I don't know the diet of the aardvark. I don't have a clue to what the robin eats differently than does the hedgehog. But Hashem does, and Hashem makes sure that it's all available, all accessible. But yarzonis olam kulo betuvo, with goodness, bechein, bechesed uverachem, with tremendous mercy, kindliness, and giving. Hu nosein lechem l'chol basar, you, Hashem, you give bread to all flesh. Ki le'olam chazdo, because forever is your chesed. Ubetuvo hagadol, and with your great goodness, tamid lo chasalanu, we've never lacked. I have never in my life gone to bed hungry because I didn't have food. And my friends, I'll share with you one more observation. There was never a Jew in the history of mankind who died of starvation. And if you'll ask me, well, if you read about the Churban Bayis, if you read about the Holocaust, there were Jews who died because of starvation. I want to share with you a very integral point. If Hashem decrees death upon a person, there are many ways that that death could be fulfilled. It could be by sword, it could be by fire, it could be by falling off a cliff, or it could be by starvation. But that's a gzar din of Misa. If a person has a decree of death, there are different ways that that decree could be fulfilled. Sometimes that decree is by starvation. But never has a Jew ever died because he didn't have food. There was a decree of death upon certain people, death by starvation. But that's Hashem's involvement saying, this is what this person needs. But never once in the history of humankind has a Jew died because he didn't have food. It never happened, never will happen, because that's Hashem's relationship with the world. He is the God who feeds and sustains everything, and does good to all, and He prepares food for all creations. Baruch Ata Hashem, blessed be You God, who feeds everything. Now, if one time a week you actually were to read those words, think about them, contemplate them, and it would bring you to such a vastly different understanding. The entire globe is run by Hashem. Hashem feels an obligation to support us, to sustain us. My food, my daily bread comes to me from Hashem, and that is a vastly different perspective. And I'd like to share with you, if you really want to work on this, two very simple things to do. They're both brought by the Mishnah Berurah. You look in Siman Kuf Pei Hei, he says, number one, you should bench from a bencher. Take a bencher and bench from it. Even if you know it Baal Peh, crystal clear. Even if you think you have more kavana, read the words inside. It helps with kavana. And there's a second eitzah, a second piece of advice that the Mishnah Berurah gives us. He says, when you're reading the words inside, read them out loud. Don't just read them with your mind's eye or just mumble them. Read the words out loud. And when you do that, a very interesting thing happens. You see, number one, it's ma'orei kavana. When you read them out loud, you awaken your own intentions. But more than that, you start doing something dramatic. You start really, really dominating, because you start speaking to your Creator. You start communicating directly to Hashem, speaking to Hashem, saying the words, Hashem, You are Hazon Esa Olam Kulo, Hashem, You feed the world. And when you speak those words out, it changes you radically. By the way, there's a guarantee that the Sefer HaChinuch brings down. And the Mishnah Berurah paskins with this guarantee. And he says these words, if you're Zohir b'Birchas HaMazon, if you're careful with benching, Mizunosa Mitzuyin lo kol yamav b'kavod, you will find your sustenance all of your days with honor, b'kavod. Find me a hedge fund that will guarantee returns. Find me a financial institution that will guarantee your money. Here is a guarantee brought by the Mishnah Berurah. He says, in the name of the Sefer HaChinuch, you are guaranteed, if you bench carefully, if you're careful in benching, your sustenance, your parnasa is guaranteed to come to you, be covered with honor. And I think this is a tremendous piece of advice. I believe there's a tremendous lesson to learn from this Gemara. When the Gemara tells us that Hashem is Mesav, Hashem desires the Tfilosim Shel Tzaddikim, not because Hashem is cruel, not because Hashem is mean, but because these people needed it. Yes, they davened, but davening by saying the words is vastly different than when you turn to Hashem and you say, I can't do it. Hashem, I cannot sustain myself. I cannot bring children into this world. I cannot continue. Hashem, I rely on You and I trust in You. And then when that thing is granted, the person who made that request has a vastly different perspective on life. You understand that life is that virtual roller coaster. It's all a mirage. It's all a bluff. All of those scary drops, all of those horrible scenes in front of you are just a bluff, just a mirage. You view the world differently. Ultimately, it's a tremendous challenge that a person is given to literally go out there, be very, very diligent, very vigilant in my ishtalas, knowing all the while it's a fake, it's a bluff. But that challenge is something that a person can only really conquer if he does this great mechanism, this great tool called davening, called tefillah, because tefillah changes everything and allows me to see things in a vastly different way. I'd like to close with one last observation. And that is, what the Gemara is telling us is that the Mos and Avos were challenged. But I want to put that into perspective for a minute. When the Jewish nation is in trouble, we daven to Hashem in the Schus of the Avos. Hashem, remember the Akedah Shitzak. Hashem, remember the greatness of the Avos and the Mos. Throughout history, we rely on their Schusim. What Hashem did was, Hashem put them into a situation where the Schusim would not be enough. When they were barren, the Sfarno explains to us, for them to have children would be the equivalent of Trias HaMesim, the equivalent of resurrection of the dead. They physically didn't have the organs, physically were incapable. Hashem put them in a place where all of their schusim, as great as they were, all of their merits, could not bring them children. Why did Hashem do that? So that they would daven. But here's the observation. if they were in a situation where all of their great merits, everything that they had accomplished, couldn't bring them children, what in the world would do it? If their Kedesh Yitzhak wouldn't bring children, if Sarah's years and years of being the tremendous tzaddikas that she was wouldn't bring children, what in the world could possibly bring children to her? And the answer is exactly what Chazal say, tefillah could have done it. All of their merits, all of their actions, everything they accomplished may not have brought them to the schus of having children, but what would have brought it to them? This thing called tefillah. And there's a tremendous, tremendous concept here. And that is, there are many, many times when I'll stand in front of Hashem and I'll make a request. And I may say to myself, you know what? Who says I'm worthy? Who says that I'm roy of what I'm asking for? And the answer may well be correct, that I'm not worthy. But understanding that I'm not really standing in front of Hashem in the schus system. I'm not asking Hashem in the merit of myself, not even the merit of my grandparents. Hashem, I'm begging mercy. Hashem, please have rahmanis. That system of using the koach of tefillah, using the power of davening, can change Hashem from the midah of din to the midah of rachamim, can make Hashem act with more mercy. The avos with all their schusim cannot have children, but this thing called tefillah could have, and in our own lives, if we use this system, it could bring us to things that we couldn't have accomplished otherwise. Hashem grant us wisdom and understanding to put this into practice.